Last week I started by saying that one of the most frequent sentences I hear is, "Shai, I have an idea." Oh, good. Right. This week, is the other frequent sentence I get is, yeah, but whatever, you know, he was just lucky. Really? That's what we're going to explore tonight. David Brown is with us. Serendipity or hard work? And just to give the academic a respray on this, we were looking this up. Where does one define serendipity and luck in the game of entrepreneurship? Well, domain of prior knowledge, you know something. You're a chemist, you're a physicist, you're IT, whatever, a policymaker, etc. You're searching for something because you're alert. You have an intention to change something that's going on around you. As a result of which, you put yourself in a position where, things happen, you observe things, and so there's a crossover point between these two or three areas of expertise, of search, and the chance occurrence of things around you, and how do you grab hold of them? So that's kind of the single model, if you like, we want to explore. So how to improve your chances of success? Let's welcome David Brown on stage. Thank you.
Well, good evening. Thank you to Shai for inviting me this evening, and thank you all for coming. Just introduce myself. I actually live only about... Sorry, my throat's in a bad way. And I actually live very close to Cambridge. I grew up around here. I've worked all over the world, including living in Switzerland for a while when I was working for a company there. I trained as a chemist originally, a mixed chemistry, biochemistry degree. I worked for 28 years in large pharmaceutical companies, worked for four of the top 10 companies, eventually rose to be head of drug discovery globally for Hoffmann La Roche in Switzerland, responsible for their 2,000 scientists. I've discovered three drugs I've got to market, actually, not just Viagra, and my fourth, I hope, is on the way, a treatment for cholera, which is what I'm working on at the moment. For the last 10 years, I've actually been working in small companies, in startups, and the mention of raising 800,000 for Abcam certainly brought back memories. My very first task when I left big companies and went to a small one was to raise $30 million for the company I became chief executive of. I would say it's the toughest thing I ever did. The company would have gone bankrupt if I hadn't got the money, but we got it in 5 months, and the company is doing very well now, I have to say. I currently chair three startup companies. Last week I was begging money in Paris for one of them from French venture capitalists, and they've given it to us, I'm glad to say. This is a startup out of Imperial College. And I also chair Babyrum Research Campus, which is an incubator site where we start companies as well. We have 31 startup companies on the site. So I span big companies and small companies, as you can see from my history. What I'm going to tell you tonight about the discovery of Viagra, the lessons are not just lessons that apply to intrapreneurship, as Shai called it, inside big companies. Actually, they're totally the same for startups as well. I really see no difference at all. Okay. In the document that Shai sent, which maybe some of you have read, he speaks about systematic exploration and also spontaneous recognition. Systematic meaning you set out very rigorously to actually find something. A spontaneous recognition meaning, well, maybe something that comes along quite accidentally, and maybe you merge the two. That's actually what happened to some extent with Viagra. I would say there are other factors, though, and I'm going to talk about those. Timeliness, creativity, and excellent execution. And I have several slides on each of those five factors in the second part of the presentation. So the first part will be just about four or five slides on the history of the discovery of Viagra. The second part will be a discussion of these five factors that I think go into the discovery of anything. And the third part will just be relating again to the document that Shai sent out, which refers to various academic theories of entrepreneurship. And I'll make comments on those different theories from my own experience. Okay, so as I said, are the success factors different in startups and large companies? No, I think they're exactly the same. So what I'm going to tell you about the discovery of Viagra, I think, applies exactly the same to startups and small companies. there's a lot of information on some of these slides. Can you actually read them at the back? can you see this print okay? Yeah. These slides are going to go on the web after the presentation. Therefore, I've put a little bit more detail on some of them than would be normal. So you can actually understand the full story. If they were just headings, actually, it would be difficult for people to make sense of it, I think. So I put more information on. If you can't read some of the words, just follow what I'm saying instead. So when I got my PhD, I joined what was called ICI Pharmaceuticals, it's now called AstraZeneca in Cheshire. I worked there for 10 years. That was really my apprenticeship, I would say, in learning drug discovery. And in 1985, Pfizer in Sandwich, Kent, recruited me to head one of the chemistry departments there. And I had about 20 chemists reporting to me when I first started there. The very first project I worked on was what became Viagra. I only had three chemists working on this project. It was very low priority. Frankly, nobody wanted the project for most of the time I was working on it. It was a pretty tough thing most of the way through. I was named inventor on the global patents together with two of my colleagues who are still very close friends. As I've mentioned, in the years since that, after 10 years at Pfizer in 1995, I moved to other jobs. Discovering Viagra didn't do my career any harm, let's put it that way. I then moved to the startup arena as chief executive of a small biotechnology company. I'm now an independent researcher. I did actually make a reasonable amount of money out of my career, and as soon as I could, I took my independence and did the research I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was focus on diarrheal diseases in developing countries. There are about 1.5 to 2 million babies, infants dying of cholera, dysentery, E. coli, rotavirus, and a few other things. Those children shouldn't be dying, so a large part of my efforts for the last 10 years have been dedicated to that, working with One World Health in San Francisco and funded by Bill Gates. On Western diseases, I do some work locally on pain and inflammation, which is a specialist area for me. And as I said, I'm on the board of several biotechnology companies. Okay, so the Viagra project, let's just go through. There are four slides on this. So when I joined Pfizer, I had just two projects to start with. The low priority project was this one. We had 20 chemists working on the other project that the management regarded as being the winner. And that did actually produce a drug that went to clinical trials, but it did not get to market. So lesson number one, we're all very poor at selecting the winners. So the Viagra project was a low priority project, it's seen as high risk. It didn't start as a treatment for erectile dysfunction. It actually went through three different uses. We started originally looking for a drug to lower blood pressure. Now, it had been discovered in 1985, published in the scientific literature, that the heart is actually an endocrine organ. It releases a hormone called atrionatrectic peptide, AMP. It's a 36 amino acid peptide. Before that, we thought the heart was just a pump, but actually it does secrete hormones that have other effects. And this peptide dilates blood vessels and causes diuresis, but its particularly striking feature is that it's what's called a potassium-sparing diuretic action. Losing potassium as you lose urine actually can cause potassium imbalance and lead to arrhythmias and potentially heart attacks. So this looked like the ideal kind of profile for an antihypertensive agent. So that's where we started. The progress was very slow. The technology we had at the time was very poor compared with modern standards. And frankly, for 3 years, we'd really made very little progress. The key breakthrough was in 1988, in 1989, two key things happened. First of all, we made sufficient progress that the profile began to look more like a drug used for treating angina. So we switched the objective into a drug for treating angina, and there was a medical need for that, as well as for a new antihypertensive. But we still were probably going to fail in the project as it was at the time. The key thing that happened was that some new technology was invented in 1988 that we got access to in 1989 called FPLC, fast protein liquid chromatography. What it does is allow you to purify proteins. And the target we were working on, an enzyme, a protein, we got for the first time in pure form in 1989 through a collaboration with Miles Housley at Glasgow. That really was a key breakthrough. So another lesson here, and this is where the timeliness comes in, is that you do need a bit of luck with the technology sometimes. The junction of that technology coming along just when we needed it probably saved the project from being closed and probably saved the project from failing. Gave us access to the target in pure form. Within 12 months, we then had made and discovered the drug that became Viagra. That new technology intersecting with our project was a key event. So the molecule we discovered, you'll hear me use different terms. UK92480 was the code name given inside the company when it was just one of many tens of thousands of chemicals. Once it got to phase two clinical trials, once it was beginning to look like a product, it was giving a chemical name, sildenafil citrate. And then eventually the trade name Viagra was invented just before the drug was launched in 1988. Another twist to this story, which I'll go into later, is it's actually sold for two indications. We were working on it to lower blood pressure. It turns out that the profile is very effective against pulmonary hypertension, which is a devastating disease both in adults and infants, particularly in infants. I won't go into what the disease is, but the drug is actually saving many thousands of lives a year in infants with pulmonary hypertension, but it's sold under the trade name Revatio. Okay, so in 1990, UK92480 was selected to progress to clinical trials in humans to assess its efficacy in angina. We nearly lost it in the first few months. We hit two major problems. So here comes the next lesson. Successful products really need people who champion them and understand them in depth to solve the problems that arise as you move forward. The two problems we hit were these. First of all, it formed a chemical crystalline form that was absolutely, totally insoluble. The chemist that was scaling it up hit this crystalline form and couldn't make it in any other way. They had to persevere for a long time to get back to a different polymorph, as it's called, that was soluble and could be absorbed in the body. But that alone could have killed the product. The other problem was, it was sent for animal safety testing to a contract research organization in Germany who reported to us that it was lethal. Now, they were putting it into rats for safety evaluation. We had put it into rats to test its efficacy, and we thought it was about the mildest, safest drug we'd ever seen. And yet they were saying it was lethal. And they would not back down from this position. Eventually, they owned up that they had mixed up our drug with somebody else's. If they hadn't, again, that would have been the end of it. If they had been sufficiently dishonest to not own up to their mistake. So, but it was only because I and a colleague, I was now leading the clinical development team for the drug, we knew this drug was not dangerous. So we just would not let up in going back to them and saying, you're wrong, you know, give us the real data. Okay, so in 1991, it moved into what are called phase one clinical trials. Clinical trials go through three stages, phase one, two, and three. Phase one is usually not in patients, it's in volunteers, quite often medical students, but it can be anybody from the general population. And generally, you're just starting at a very low dose, titrating upwards, making sure it's tolerated, safe, but also measuring how the body handles it, because it doesn't matter how much work you do in animals, humans can be a little bit different, and you need to find out the pharmacokinetics. The drug was totally normal, uneventful, no problems at all. Now the key event. We started phase two trials in angina. I was leading this team for 2 years going through these trials. The bottom line was we were heading for failure because I had not been given enough money by the management to recruit enough patients to do a big enough trial to show the drug is effective. In other words, the response from placebo, from untreated, was overlapping the response from the drug. In fact, to the best of my knowledge at the time, no drug that was used was in clinical use for angina could have been shown effective in the size of trial that we were that we were doing. So we were heading for failure. So it got to the summer of 1993, and the head of R&D for Pfizer Europe said to me in a meeting in June that year, David, come back in 3 months. You know, you've wasted enough time and money. We're going to kill this in September if you've not got good results in angina. I think it was about 2 weeks after that, we were doing another pharmacokinetic study in Cardiff, medical students, in a clinical pharmacology unit overnight. And this, so these were not angina patients, these were medical students, and we were just trying to do a biomarker study. We're trying to measure various parameters in normal people. The clinical research associate, a young lady who was running the trial, gave them a questionnaire to fill in at the end of the trial, and nothing remarkable on it at all. And then she asked a question she was meant to ask. It's an open question. Did you notice anything else? And one of them put the hand up and said, I seem to have more erections overnight than usual. And they were all men in the trial, and all the others said, yeah, so did we. So that was the discovery of Viagra. She came back into my office the next day and told me this news, and I must say she went, you know, she blushed very deeply, and then asked to be taken off the project, because she couldn't handle what was going to happen next, I think. So we very quickly converted it into a project for a different use. Now, this is the next lesson. A number of things intersected. And this was coming to hard work and serendipity. This was where serendipity and hard work intersected. First of all, about 9 months before this, there had been publication in the scientific literature of the biochemical role of a gas called nitric oxide in the body. Nobody has suspected that nitric oxide has such important roles, but it does. It's used in virtually every vessel, blood vessel in your body. Nitric oxide works through the same system that we knew UK92480 works through. And we worked out from that it could therefore dilate blood vessels in the corpus cavernosum, which is the blood vessel in the penis that opens up during an erection. So actually, because we understood the science, we understood exactly why this was happening. If we hadn't understood it, you know, it would have been difficult to interpret, did it mean anything? But knowing, since the science had just broken in the literature 9 months before, we understood it. So at that point, I went to the head of clinical research at Pfizer and said, look, you know, I know nobody wants this drug, and everybody wants to kill it, and the R&D head has said it's going to close in a few months. We've got this amazing result. Can I have some money to do a study in impotence patients? He said no. His budget was overspent, and you know, he wasn't going to stick his neck out having sat through the meetings when nobody wanted this drug anyway. He had no knowledge of the impotence market, by the way. I did, because as I'll come to in a moment, because I'd done some research earlier for another reason. Basically, I said to him, I'm not leaving your office until you give me the money. And I didn't. You know, having sat through 8 years of, you know, leading this project for 8 years and believing actually we've got a breakthrough drug and then being told we're not going to even do a small study, I just wasn't going to give up. But an hour later, he gave me the money. Now, that was, again, a key event. First of all, me being stubborn, and second, him having the flexibility, and I would say, good for him. You know, he stuck his neck out against the senior management who were trying to kill this project and gave me the money. He could have been in deep trouble, but he gave me the money. So we set up a small trial with male impotence patients in South Meath Hospital in Bristol. You just couldn't miss the effect. 10 of the 12 reported improved erectile function compared with only 2 on placebo. And then everybody got very excited, of course. Suddenly the management wanted the drug. It went from dead to number one priority in the whole Pfizer global portfolio in the space of 2 weeks. Again, Pfizer were primed. They understood there was a market here. So this is another lesson. It's not just serendipity, it's being prepared. As Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind. I'll come to why Pfizer understood this in a moment. Things also got very difficult with the patients. We'd given them the drug for 7 days. They had had one assessment inside a clinic, watching blue movies, hooked up to a thing called a Rigiscan. I'll leave this to your imagination. And then had taken the drug home to their partners. And then after 7 days, we asked them to give the drug back. Well, we only had permission from regulatory authorities for the men to use it for 7 days. They wouldn't give the drugs back. Surprise, surprise. But we had to get it back, otherwise we were legally responsible for the fact that they were taking a drug that we weren't authorized to give them for more than 7 days. I had a letter from one that I'll never forget. He said, "You have to understand, I'm sorry I haven't given you the drug back, but you have to understand my wife and I are having a sex life for the first time for years, and this means an enormous amount to us, and you're asking me to give this drug back." What we had to do was promise those same men that as soon as we have permission for more extended study, they would be recruited to the very next trial and would get the drug back again. And we did. Okay, at this point I stopped leading the project, having suffered it for 8 years and had a pretty tough time with it, I have to say. As soon as it was a great success, somebody else took over leading it, and I was not happy. But it was an appropriate decision, because at this point it became a major development program. It had to be led by a clinician, not by myself. It went into large phase 2b trials, initially in the UK, using some of those same patients, as I said, and also France, Norway, Sweden. The level of efficacy we saw in those trials was quite stunning again. More than 90% of the patients responded, which is virtually unheard of for any drug. The total phase 2b and phase 3 trials took 3 years, 1993 to 1997. In fact, I was involved in the planning of those trials right at the beginning, and I have to say it was very impressive the way they were executed. So, when I come back to one of the messages about effective execution, Pfizer really did do that. It was a very effective machine in producing the data required from for this drug. It went to the USA FDA, Federal Drug Administration, for approval, Pfizer being an American company, of course, and the US being the largest market. It was rushed through by the FDA, I think, in about 6 or 8 months. Usually they take 2 to 2.5 years. It was regarded as a breakthrough medicine. There might be 1 or 2 or 3 like this every year out of the 20 or 30 they approve. So it was a rarity in that sense, and they moved it very fast. 1998, it was made available in the US and UK and other countries. It received such massive publicity. I don't know if any of you remember the time. I was really caught up in it myself at the time. It was almost as if Pfizer had to do anti-marketing to sort of reduce the hype. It really got a little bit out of hand at times and began to worry them, I think. Within the first year, its sales became amongst the fastest growing ever. So launched in April 1998 in the USA, in the week of 8th of May, so this is only 1 month after launch, more than 300,000 prescriptions written. In the first quarter alone, $400 million worth of sales. Now, in those days, $500 million in a year was regarded as a blockbuster, a really, really big drug. And that was achieved just in the first 12 weeks on the market. Pfizer really didn't have to market this drug, it sold itself. Total sales to date, I've had to estimate these figures. It's actually quite difficult. I know that Pfizer's sales are of that order, $23 to $25 billion. It's likely to be in the range of $30 to $40 billion. Pfizer also sell it for Revatio of pulmonary hypertension, as I said. That was only launched in 2005. I'll tell you the story of that on a later slide. But that's earning $500 million a year already and growing very fast. Viagra's coming off patent in most countries now. It came off patent in the UK in June this year. It comes off patent in the US in March next year. However, Pfizer obtained a method of use patent in the US that runs out to 2018, and they are able to maintain their hold on the market in the US because of that patent through to that time. And they're earning about $1 billion a year in the US at the moment, so their figure here is going to go into the 30, 35 billion range, I would think. There are other uses being identified all the time. I'll show you about on a later slide. I would think that once you add in all the internet sales, counterfeit sales, and the current coming generics, the sales of this are probably over 40 billion at the moment and still going up. Okay, a little bit about the second use. This is the use that's saving a lot of lives in babies and young children, but also in some elderly people as well. Pulmonary arterial hypertension is a lethal condition. You don't need to read all this, but basically what happens is that you get high blood pressure in the lungs, basically, and the heart is pumping against that, trying to pump against high resistance in the heart, and it actually leads to heart failure. One of the ventricles actually fails because of that and leads to death. So you get right-sided heart failure. The history of this was that physicians were actually using Viagra off-label, as it's called, to treat these babies. They knew it worked. Had found out almost by accident, I think, or probably by working it out from the mechanism. Pfizer weren't able to promote it for that because the trials hadn't been done, but between 2000 and 2005 they did, and then they got permission to sell it in 2005, 8 years after its introduction for impotence. And they gave it a new name to avoid confusion of Viagra, and the dose is a bit lower as well. Other uses, these four are pretty well validated now, and there are others as well. Altitude sickness is probably the most trivial of them. And this basically comes back down to pulmonary edema again. It's the same problem as high blood pressure in the lungs and the heart having to pump against it. It's exactly the same thing as pulmonary arterial hypertension. Raynaud's disease, maybe some of you suffer from this. Basically, in cold weather, your fingers don't get the circulation they need. The vessels constrict, the toes might as well, you have pain in them. It's actually very effective against that. That can actually lead to amputations in severe cases, so it's not a trivial condition. But then two very important ones, heart disease and cancer. This is now getting back to where we were actually for angina. There are now studies suggesting it might be useful in congestive heart failure or diastolic dysfunction. And in fact, angina is a precursor of heart failure, so this is getting exactly back to what we developed it for in the first place. There haven't been rigorous trials done for this, but my feeling is actually this will become a major use sometime in the future. Cancer is quite interesting. There were studies with doxorubicin, which is a drug used for killing cancer cells. The drug actually damages the heart, and it was found that Viagra actually protects the heart when doxorubicin is given. But what was found unexpectedly is it doesn't just protect the heart, you get a much greater anti-cancer effect. So there's some kind of synergy between Viagra and the cancer agent that isn't understood at the moment, but there are clinical trials planned here, and I think this is probably going to lead to another number of uses for Viagra as well. Okay, success brings problems. Counterfeiting, I'm sure you're all sick of the junk mail, just as I am. It started a whole new industry, mostly out of Russia, I'm told. But counterfeiting was a problem very early on, even as early as 2002, only 4 years after launch. An independent group estimated it was the most counterfeited drug in the world. And in 2007, Pfizer said it was as well. And I think that probably is still the case. I think that's a comment almost on the safety of the drug. It's an incredibly safe drug. People aren't taking a lot of risk using the drug that they get from the internet. The risk they're taking, of course, is it may not be sildenafil citrate, it might be something else. So personally, I would not recommend that you get this drug over the internet. I'd recommend you get it from your physician for that reason. Okay, now this drug probably transformed Pfizer, actually. I guess none of you had heard of the company before that. It was actually number five in the world at the time, before the launch. This is the share price in dollars. This is what happened at the time of the launch. It went up about two, threefold. largely, I think, because of Viagra. What that allowed them to do was to access capital. Because the valuation of the company went up, they could then access capital and use that capital to acquire other companies. They acquired Warner Lambert, Park Davis and Wyeth, and eventually became the biggest company in the world. Okay, maybe I've made it sound easy. It wasn't. Enormous amount of hard work went into this. It took 13 years' work, a lot of money, a lot of risk to bring it into medical use. It came to failure close to failure many times, and I'm sure this is true of any successful product and most successful companies. It's never a straight line path to success. When I put dogged persistence and small dedicated team, I think if you look at any success story, you'll find it's the same. It looks a great success now, but I can tell you at the time, as I said, it was very low priority, it was difficult, it was unwanted for many years, and sometimes quite stressful. So there are many factors important into the success of this, and I'm going to go through those now. So now I'm going to refer back to these five factors. Systematic exploration. These factors I'm going to go through now are actually standard practice in the pharmaceutical industry at this time. They were not in the 1980s. Pfizer actually innovated in doing many of these things, and I think it was part of the reason. Pfizer were actually number 13 in the world when I joined them in 1985, and they went to number one. I think it was some of this kind of systematic approach to research that made a big difference to them. First of all, medical need. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Market size and what I call product profiles. These are three key parameters. In fact, these will be relevant to any business at all. You need to understand where there's a need, need to understand what the market size is, and you need to understand you need to predefine the profile of the product you're going to produce and know that it will meet the medical need and the market. So market need analysis. hypertension, angina, the first two indications. Pfizer were actually very strong in cardiovascular R&D. They were one of the strongest in the world. So they understood those markets. They were able to do the market analysis and the medical needs analysis, and were able to identify the target product profile correctly. Other companies that were not deep in that area could not have produced this project. In fact, we had no competition. I've got this on a later slide. Nobody else was working on this mechanism in this way. We had no competition for, 6 or 7 years. Nobody else spotted this opportunity. Male erectile dysfunction. Now, this was different. Pfizer had no experience in this. Nobody was selling a drug for this indication. But what had happened is that a colleague and I, almost by chance, really, have proposed working on male erectile dysfunction about 2 or 3 years earlier, and we had done the market analysis. We'd gained all the information. Just think how important that is. For some reason, we had done this analysis, so as soon as we saw this effect, not only did we understand there was a market there, and the science had just come along at the right time to say we understand how this works. Those three things triangulated at a particular point in time. Maybe that's what's needed for breakthroughs quite often. This proposal to work in erectile dysfunction was rejected by the senior management at the time, but it meant, as I said, that when we had this unexpected observation, we were primed, we were ready, we knew it was important. That is serendipity. On to the next factor, target product profile. This is a very detailed analysis of benefit to the patient, as I call it. It's now standard practice in the industry. It wasn't 20 years ago. Pfizer were the innovators in introduction of these, and it had a very clear and powerful effect on directing the projects, on their efficiency of the organization, and on success. So again, this kind of very directed approach intersects with the creativity and the serendipity. This is an example of a current target product profile. This isn't Viagra. This is one I'm working on at the moment. Hopefully this is going to be my fourth drug to market. So this is the one I'm working on for cholera with One World Health, funded by Bill Gates. Just look down here. These are the things that matter. You know, what's the impact going to be? It's going to address 80% of the 1.8 to 2 million deaths. Indication and usage. So there it's going to be effective against E. coli, cholera, rotavirus, etc., etc. Target population, pediatrics and adults. Mechanism, route of administration, dosing schedule, efficacy, safety. So you define each of these things very carefully. It usually takes weeks or months to define a document like this, and it goes around many people from many disciplines, and it keeps getting challenged continuously. Another drug that I got to market, Relpax and migraine, we got the target product profile wrong. We were within a week of closing the project. I realized at that point we got the target product profile wrong and we got it changed. And we had already made the drug Relpax and thrown it out. When we changed the target product profile and got it right, we realized the drug was in clinical development 4 months after that event. So this is a really important document. If you get this wrong, you miss inventions. Not only do you have this benefit to the patient, there's another one called a target compound profile. I'm not going to tell you because it would only be understood by chemists. But it's actually the chemistry, the chemical profile that will achieve that benefit to the patient. So you have two documents like this. So this is very carefully thought through, directed discovery. Okay, spontaneous recognition. So intersecting then with that very structured, thoughtful approach, a number of things contributed here. First of all, recognition in 1985 that AMP was released from the heart, and it led to the startup of the project. That was obviously a very key event. No other company started working on this at this time. Second recognition, and this was actually one of my contributions, was that a chemical template published for use by another company could be modified to give the central template of 92480 Viagra. That was the key, well, the first step in the drug design. Recognition that the biological profile observed partway through the discovery phase resembled a nitrate, and that was like glycerol trinitrate leading to redirection towards angina. So another recognition. And then finally, the observation of the erections in the volunteers. So there were four events here that had big go, no-go impacts on the project, spontaneous recognition. Timeliness. So I've mentioned these already, but just to summarize them here, two very timely scientific technical advances, the invention of this machinery only a year before in 1988, which we got access to in 1989, allowed us to have the drug only 12 months later. And then publication of new knowledge in the early 1990s about the role of nitric oxide allowed us to interpret the effect that we saw unexpectedly. In fact, somebody got the Nobel Prize for that discovery of the effect of nitric oxide. And then observation of the erections after the prior proposal to work on MED meant, as Louis Pasteur said, chance favors a prepared mind. We knew there was a medical need, we knew there was a market, because the colleague and I had done this analysis about 2 or 3 years before. So when we made this observation, we were, if you like, primed and strong enough to persuade the senior management that we need to switch, we need to do this. Okay, creativity. Start up the project. As I said, no other research group followed the same approach. We had no competition for many years. So that was definitely a creative step. Design of the molecule 92480 that became Viagra. Really, all drug design is hard work. It mostly fails. I don't know if you know the success rates for drug discovery, but probably less than 1 in 100 drug discovery projects actually gets a drug to market. It's probably a lot less than 1 in 100, but that's the kind of figure that's usually quoted. It's particularly hard, though, for breakthrough medicines. There's no precedent for successful design of the drug versus the target class, and there's no precedent for design of the biological assays. In fact, there's no precedent for the clinical program either. You can get any of those three wrong. So these kind of programs are by far the most risky. And in fact, the patent strategy here was inventive as well. Pfizer are going to have probably another $5 to $10 billion worth of sales because of the inventive patent strategy they put in place around this drug as well. And it's, for people starting new companies, the IP, the industrial property, is critical. You cannot get funding from venture capitalists if you've not got a very strong IP position. So it's something that really needs to be thought about and get expert input to. Excellent execution. I would say that the research side at Pfizer at Sandwich, the 10 years I worked there, was one of the best managed, I would think, anywhere in the world. We had 5 blockbuster drugs from that site in 10 years with a very small research group. It was amongst the most productive ever. And it really came down to leadership, just 3 very good leaders, I would say. In addition to the organisation, the project was very well managed, and we actually all liked working together, very strong teamwork, and even after all these years, we're still very close friends. That was very important as well. Doggedness in obtaining the money to fund the initial 12-patient study. You know, if I'd have given up at that point, well, the drug would never have been invented. And then, as I mentioned before, the really excellent execution of the clinical program over those 4 years. We put a schedule together in 1993, but 1997, they completed that schedule, only slipped, I think, about 4 or 6 weeks, which is very, very good. And then the pre-launch publicity of the drug was unprecedented. As I said, it was probably too good, and they probably had to do a little bit of anti-publicity at some point. This slide is one slide taken from a whole presentation I give, so I'm not going to go into it in great detail. But the 3 P's model of leadership and management, if you don't know this model, I'd recommend that you read a little bit about it. I found it over the years to be really good. Excellent execution is actually very difficult and very rare. I've worked in a lot of places over the last 35 years, and good leadership actually isn't that common. And good management further down the organization isn't that common. I think if you study this, you'll see that having a clear understanding of what your purpose is, this is where, for instance, the product profiles, etc., came in, understanding the processes for managing the teams, and also the whole sort of team effectiveness, the intersection of the purpose, people, and process is really important. I won't go through this because I'll end up talking for an hour on it if I do, but if you're interested, I do have a slide set I can send to Shai and send on to you that goes into this in great depth. All 3 important for excellent execution. If any one of those 3 is weak, then it tends to set you up for a difficult time and potentially failure. Also, behaviours. I mean, all this kind of thing is a very human endeavour. Individual and team behaviours can be absolutely determinant of success. Management decisions can make or break a project and a company. Another company, a few years later, had their own Viagra. They gave it away. They decided there wasn't a market. They had the wrong marketing information. I'm not going to tell you which that company is. You can work it out for yourself. That drug is now sold by another company and is earning $2 billion a year. One management decision. One could have made a massive difference to that company. So, the bottom line here, I'm going to use the word governance. Governance is central. Effective governance of a project, organization, will strongly determine success or failure. It doesn't matter how creative you are, how good your ideas are, how much drive you've got. If you're working with people that are going to make bad decisions and they have authority over you, you're going to get undermined. You have to find some way around them or go work somewhere else. Okay, does this fit the academic models? So the paper that Shai sent out had, I don't know how many of you read it, but it had various comments on academic models. And I'm just going to, I picked out a few key phrases from each of these. So this one, fit what's called the prescriptive model, in which discovery is really a systematic search. Well, yes, there was an element of this, the medical need analysis, the market research, and the target product profiles. I keep coming back to Louis Pasteur's comment, chance favors the prepared mind. You're not prepared unless you've done that background. You really need that foundation to put in context any discovery that you make. Kurtzner, accidental discovery model. Yes, there's also an element of this, the report of erections and clinical study, which was designed for other purposes. There was a quotation of another author suggesting that if alertness is the real competence, then maybe it just amounts to luck. Well, luck, I'd call it preparedness, and I think that really is a key phrase. Shane, entrepreneurs discover opportunities related to the information they already possess. Yes, it led to the initial startup and focus of the project. The scientific literature published in the early 1990s led us to understand the erections that were observed, so we actually knew that it was real. And it's helping now to identify other uses for Viagra as well. Understanding the scientific basis for the effect of this drug can point you to other medical uses. So yes, there's an element of that as well. Domains of opportunity discovery. So, you know, this one I think makes a lot of sense. You know, just saying that there's a role for serendipity, but it lies somewhere between very structured and very lucky, in that individuals are involved in some kind of search effort when they actually discover something that they were not looking for, and that's exactly what happened here. And then this one, while chance plays a role, it can't possibly act in isolation, must be intertwined with choice and causal background to ensure success. And that's very true. Chance observations more likely to be recognized and exploited if that's the case. So I think all these models have some merit. I don't think any one of them alone captures my experience, but they all have some merit. So some final thoughts here. You know, my experience through many years of research work is that you never actually know which are going to be the winners. You just have to plant lots of seeds. You use your judgment, you know, but if you have lots of ideas, you've got a lot more chance of succeeding than if you've only got one idea. Let's put it that way. Constantly question and challenge what you're doing. I gave the example of the drug Relpax, which would have, you know, would never have been invented if I hadn't sat there and challenged the product profile and said, we've got this wrong. You know, literally at the last moment, we were going to kill that project the following week. It's now earning hundreds of millions a year and treating migraine patients. You may need to change direction many times. You've got to remain determined but also flexible. And there's obviously a balance here, because if you keep shifting between one thing and another, you never actually achieve anything. On the other hand, if you stay absolutely rigidly heading towards something which is inappropriate, you're not going to achieve anything either. So you've got to know when to shift your ground and try something different. And above all, I'd say, remember you can't do this alone, particularly if you're going to start a company. Relationships matter a lot. I would really say one of the key things is to maintain good relationships with the people you work with. I found in my career that the people come round and round again, you know, and I'm working again now for the second or third time with people I've worked with decades ago, and it's an enormous pleasure to do that. Know your strengths and weaknesses. Work with others that balance your skills. Don't worry about your weaknesses. Everybody's got weaknesses. You can't be brilliant at everything. Focus on your strengths, but choose to work with people who are strong in areas that you're not strong in. That's the way to do it. And above all, network like crazy. You know, get all the help you can. I would say the secret of success is networking above all else. You know, just be very clear what you want to do. Tell people what you want to do. And just get out there and network. And usually you find something comes along to help you achieve what you want to do. Networking is really important. I think that's the last slide. Yeah. So over to you now. And I'm happy to answer any questions best I can.